So would you introduce yourselves, please?
Hi, I'm John Keeble.
I'm Tony Hadley.
Gary Kemp.
Steve Norman.
And Martin Kemp.
This has to be done in harmony. And you're in a band called...
Spandau Ballet.
Or as ballet, as you say.
Ballet.
Spandau Ballet. Are you guys, and I'm a nice New York Jewish boy, are you guys from that ballet band? So let's get something out of the way fast. This reunion happened not today in 2014. This is 2009, right? So it's been, you've had a little time by the time that this film comes out, which we'll talk about, yeah. By the time you've had a little time to get used to each other again, or not.
Yeah. Now we're having a fantastic time, I have to say. I mean, we haven't played together since June 2010. So it has been 4 years. And I suppose the reason we're sort of back together again is because we want to be, obviously, but also because the catalyst has been the film. And then this festival has enabled us to premiere the film. And hey, guys, do you want to play a set? We're having such a good time. It's unbelievable. I'm enjoying myself.
No, but the film is how many years in the making? The film is, because you said, you know, 2010, right? And we're in 2014. So this has been a Herculean effort for everybody concerned,
yeah,
right?
We, I guess the seed was planted on the last tour because we had one tune in particular, a song called Round and Round, that as we performed it, we put up some various home movie footage that we'd taken from the 80s, the very early 80s, of us really behind the scenes larking about, you know, showing the sort of humanistic side of us and as people. And the audience absolutely lapped it up. We got one of the biggest cheers of the whole tour of the evening. And so that kind of, we then thought, well, look, we've got a few more of this footage. And also, what a great idea to document Spandau and also the 80s and that whole decade, how we came about, set the scene politically, socially, and of course tell our story, which we do have a fairly decent story. And that's how it came about. So about 2 years ago, we started looking for stuff. As you mentioned, we had 400 hours of footage that George Henken, who directed the film, sort of trawled through before putting her fantastic editorial stamp on it.
And she still looked alive. When I saw her the other day, she, unless there was an automaton, she was talking good.
But the Rolling Stones had their movie out, and I was watching it with Gary, and I said to him, wouldn't it be great if we had a film like this? And Gary says, yeah, but we haven't got enough moving footage. And in the end, 400 hours came about, you know, so we did, yeah.
I think this is, after the last tour, and after that, getting back together again, which was, as you may know, was a huge process for that to happen. I think what we realized when we came to the end of that tour, and we'd had the most fun on any tour we'd ever had, and we actually ended up as the biggest tour we ever did, that we had a really unique story. We had a really very unique beginning. You know, I think the way the film just shows you, you know, we come out of a real youth culture movement in the UK. Just ordinary working class boys shot onto some huge global stage. And then we crashed. And it was then, I think, that we realized we had a really great three-act story that maybe were we brave enough to really face the facts and let the story run in front of our eyes. And I think the only way we could possibly do that was by being outside the door and not bothering George when she was editing. And that was really what we wanted to do.
You know, I think that's, we wanted to make a film that was actually documented a decade and a time and could be interesting on a sort of social history level, but could also be interesting for people who had no, they don't care about the band or know about the band. We screened it to a lot of young people who were fascinated by it. But, you know, there is a real story of friendship at the heart of it all, as Steve was saying.
But I learned some amazing things. The makers, the cut, the gentry. And my favorite that I really learned, and I guess, remember, there was no Wikipedia, right, for us to learn about you until a couple of years ago. And so I'm thinking, okay, you know, when I really found out what a Spandau Ballet was, and I got twitchy. I really did. I kind of was like, ooh, these are things that the film's really going to help people with, is when they go back and they listen to the songs now, they're really going to see the history of the band in these songs. And I think that's a killer function of what's going on today, right now in this room, and with the film.
I think that's, the backstory. You know, a lot of people are unaware of you know, the few years before, cut a long story short, you know, we sort of dropped into the world as Spandau Ballet. And people are going, wow, where did they come from? Yeah, but you know, in actuality, you know, this story started in the school music room, you know, when we were, you know, teenagers. So we'd done a bit of the hard yards before we arrived on Planet Pop, you know.
But isn't it so important for people to know that? Because people really assume, oh, you just learned to sing.
You
came out of the
woman,
boom.
Yeah, I'm Frank Sinatra. I think you're right. I think a lot of people, because it was such an instant success as well, especially in America with True. That was the first you guys really heard of us, and these five nice guys dressing in nice suits. And there was a massive history before that. And so I suppose in some ways we might have come across as a manufactured band to some people. But as John said, there's a massive history that goes back to when we were 16. So we've certainly... We've grafted and paid our dues.
You know, I think also
you think
True became what it became. We all know that. But when we first did that, that was really quite subversive for us. It was unusual for white kids like ourselves to have a punt at what was really, you know, black territory. Really, to do a Blue Eyed Soul record, and
way before Hall & Oates.
Yeah, you know, I think we were you know. Everything has to be, you know, gets taken out of context as time goes by, really. I think what where the film has a strength as well is anybody interested in British pop culture. And this is the next stage on. We all know about the 70s, so well documented, and the 60s, obviously. But the 80s have not really been that well documented in movies. And I think this is the one.
The new, I'm going to do it in big quotes, the new romantic movement. The whole part of rock and roll is you get to dress up. You get to play. You get to have fun. And now rock and roll today, and I'm not putting it down because I interview lots of new bands that would die if they were in this room right now, you know, is okay, the ironic T-shirt, the ironic flannel shirt. There, even in America, we didn't have what you had. People dressed up. But the way, what I saw in that film really informed me. I think that just must have been such a blast. But how did he really know to start that?
All right. The thing is, the first groups that we got into, this is our generation, would have been the glam rock bands, like Roxy and Bowie and Bolan. So our initiation into rock music came in a very theatrical way. And what drew me to those bands was the way they looked. If I'd just heard the record on the radio, would I have bought Starman? Would I have been as enthusiastic to this day about it? Probably not. The other thing is British working class kids have always been very tribal and have been obsessed with the uniform of their tribe, whatever it might be. And we were just another wave of that. So I think, you know, dressing cool as a kid and looking special, looking quite frightening sometimes to some people, is a weapon, really.
It gets you through, right? It gets you through the day in the long run.
Well, yeah, I think what Spandau became was in the way that the Mods had the Who to represent them, and the Rolling Stones had were rockers, essentially, and were the head of that movement. I think Spandau became the head of this new romantic movement that happened.
Which so many years later now it just becomes kind of a moniker, which is kind of bizarre, in as much as new wave. But let's talk about Northern Soul. Let's talk about soul. Because you see, I was the kid in 1972 who was getting the Melody Maker. And one of the things I noticed in the Melody Maker is that all the Tamla Motown stuff that was big in the 60s in America was reconstituted in the UK in the early 70s. You got it was played back then, but then you got it again and it became hits again, which is really interesting. And then there's the whole Northern Soul movement. But when you talk about being a soul band.
Soul boy.
Yeah, soul boy. Yeah, exactly. So people here probably are still going, what does that really mean? Okay, they added a sax, right? At one moment in time, suddenly a sax appeared in some of the songs.
we were into soul music. I mean, we've done the sort of gamut of different, music. We all we've listened to the Stones. We're big fans of the Faces, all that kind of stuff. I mean, these are bands also that have touched on soul. You know, the even the Rolling Stones can be very soulful when they want to. And you know, for us. I mean, Northern Soul is a little bit different because that was in the north of the country. Yes. It emanated from Wigan. But it's all, it was all really based around dancing. And that's why you went there, to dance.
There's that great bit in the film, isn't there?
I
think that's one of my favourite bits, actually.
Yeah. And
sorry to interrupt. In the film, there's a great bit where it's a soul club and there's all black and white kids, girls, guys, whatever. Yeah. All dancing, I mean, making
the friends
moves.
Of ours in that as
yeah.
well. That
yeah, friends, the friends yeah. that we knew, making yeah. moves that I can only dream about, you know. So yeah. it's, but, you know, no, I mean, that's. I think that's a great part in the film, and it shows that kind of unique sort of British tribal thing, as Steve says.
I mean, Soul Boy was a kind of connection to mod, really. It was just working class kids who wanted to spend every penny on their clothes, who were very aspirational. And I think actually got ignored a lot by the British music press, probably because they were sort of too aspirational and not political enough. Mm-hmm. But and I think we realized that when we started as a band, and we bigged up those guys in the music press because we realized that they were getting really kind of ignored. But the pun and the irony about the Soul Boys of the Western World as the title of the movie means just ordinary white working class kids or working class kids who became huge globally. And there's a sweetness about that.
South by Southwest, right? Being in a theater that holds, you know, 1,300 people and watching this. Now, was that the first time you saw the final cut of the film? Or had you seen it?
That was the first time we'd seen the actual finished article.
Wow.
I mean, we actually... Oh, yeah, very much so.
First time together to see it, wow.
Yeah, the five of us, yeah, being in the same room.
Watching the movie with other people in a cinema is a completely different experience to watching it at home or on stream to your computer, you know, with a 5.1 stereo and watching people's reactions, especially coming from England. You know, there's comical moments in England that you don't know whether it's going to translate to America because comedy is essentially... different, you know, on both sides of the Atlantic. And so it was just nice to see people's reactions, see if people laugh in the right places and cry in the right places as well.
I mean, it's a difficult watch for us. You know, the first time we saw it, you know, back in London, you know, nearly finished, it's your life. And the great thing about the film is it's brutally honest, and everyone... you know, all five of us look at some bits of it and go, really? Did that happen? Did we say that? Did I do that? But I think that's the strength of the movie. There was no point in making this movie and, you know, sort of shaving off the rough edges. I think the beauty of it is it's brutally honest.
So I said I was going to do this, and I think it is important to talk about, because I always tell my listeners about the underbelly of the industry. I read one sheets, I read bad
Why
reviews.
Am I scared?
No, don't be scared. Okay. So you put this out over there. Where did Daniel Glass come into the picture? Because Chrysalis Records was at that point a fledgling label. Yeah.
You see, I mean, Danny, you know, with Glassnote now is one of the biggest record bosses in the country. My memory isn't great but about that particular moment when I first met Danny, but I know that Steve Dagger flew over with the tapes of the True album. And Danny, I think, quite honestly, was about the only person in the building who really got it. And he got it because Danny is the soul boy. You know, that's what he is at heart. He loves music. He loves black music. And Danny believed in that song True. He loved the whole album, but the song True he knew could cross over. And I think that was the key to that song's success, and why currently I think it's on about 5 million airplays in the US, is because it crossed over into what then was a really divided radio stations. So we were between black and white music, and it crossed over and got played on both. I mean, when we came to America the second time, Frankie Crocker introduced us on stage. You know, we were one of the first white bands to do Soul Train. You know, I mean, we couldn't believe we got Soul Train. That was the biggest buzz for us.
That was a great clip.
You know, I mean, you know, I think Bowie had done it with Young Americans, you know, so stepping into his shoes onto that stage was great. So Danny, we owe a lot to him. You know, he really punted it out there to the radio stations and the DJs and believed in it.
You hinted at this. The world can be your oyster now. And the first thing that people are going to ask you a million times, which is not what I'm going to ask, so I'll do the what you're not going to ask, is, so what's the new Spandau Ballet sound going to be like? So now that we're not asking that, what I really want to know is what you want to do. Because now you're here, you're back, you have an opportunity, and the world can be your oyster again if you want it to be. But I have a almost 13-year-old daughter. There are kids in the room. There are families in the room. There are lives in the room. And yet, once it's in your blood, you're stuck.
Oh, man.
Right?
Wow. Take that one. And go
okay.
On.
Do you know,
you just summed it up so well.
I got goosebumps when you were talking then. I want you to be my spiritual leader.
Yeah. I
think we do have an opportunity, and I think we've been shocked by the attention that we've got in America. We've been shocked by the enthusiasm, by the knowledge that people have for the band. You know, we felt we'd ignore you. You'd certainly ignore us. But actually, there's a great love here. We're desperate to come and play here now. We're desperate to come, and I think that's what we're planning to do. That and
well, we have to do, yeah, but we unfortunately neglected America, North America, for 28 years. And we didn't, you know, when we got back together again in 2009, 2010, we did a massive arena tour, but we didn't come to the States. And we have to. You'll grow to love us, I'm sure.
I had drinks with John Taylor about a year or so ago, and he goes, and he said, well, you know, the good thing is about us, he said, we didn't really compete in the end. We agreed that you had Europe and we had America. And it's like two majors on a battlefield dividing up the territory. I don't think that's true.
I saw them play here the last year or the year before, and you know,
I think this is our turn to have
there,
America.
But I want to really re-inform people about Spandau Ballet. So I've invented a thing called a musical sandwich. And what it is two of your songs, but you can have a club. So three of your songs is the bread. And then I want you each to pick two or three other songs just off the cuff. Anything that comes to mind by other people in between. And what this does is avoids a playlist.
Hey, Zane Lowe, I'm sitting here with Dennis the Menace, and he's telling me that you want to know who's the next British band that's going to break America. And I'm telling you, we're going to re-break America. This is Gary Kemp from Spandau Ballet.
Any of you want to comment on that?
No, that's the fact. That's what's going to happen.
So, Tony, have you enjoyed yourself while being in America, or what? What have you been up to?
I've had a marvellous time, been seeing lots of bands, and went to see Soundgarden, went to see Gary Newman last night, went to see Blondie, and we missed Gaga, but she was with Dennis the Menace on stage. He was a special guest, and Dennis the Menace gets everywhere. You do her outfits.
Yeah. You're good at slicing meat, then.
She didn't have a lump of steak on her head, did she?
Hey, but Dennis, no pork, right?
No.